Welcome to the Physiological Reviews podcast. Today, we will discuss a review article titled "A Systematic Review of the Biological Mediators of Fat, Taste, and Smell" that is published in the January 2023 issue of the journal. Joining us are Editor-in-Chief Dr. Sadi Madelon and author Dr. Polly Joseph.
Dr. Madelon, over to you.
Welcome to the Physiological Reviews podcast to discuss our inaugural publication of a systematic review by Dr. Polly Joseph, editorial board member of Physiological Reviews. I am Sadis Madelon, editor of Physiological Reviews, and among the top 50 most influential journals indexed in PubMed, Web of Science, and other scientific databases. Dr. Polly Joseph is a Lasker Clinical Research Scholar, clinical investigator, and chief of the section of sensory science and metabolism in the Division of Intramural Clinical and Biological Research at the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. She also has a joint appointment at the National Institute of Nursing Research, a most significant appointment because Dr. Joseph is a nurse. Dr. Joseph is conducting preclinical, clinical, and translational studies to improve the diagnosis, prevention, and management of chemosensory disorders. We are honored and delighted to have her as an editorial board member of Physiological Reviews. Dr. Joseph, congratulations to you and your co-authors on the first systematic review to be published in Physiological Reviews on biological mediators of fat, taste, and smell. It just appeared in final form in the January 23 issue. Dr. Joseph, you are a nurse, a clinical scientist, and a role model for women scientists. Please tell our readers about your background and ended up in your current position.
Thank you, Dr. Madelon, for this wonderful opportunity to do this podcast and for the wonderful introduction. It's truly an honor to be a member of the editorial board for Physiological Reviews and to really be one, provide one of the first systematic reviews in the journal. It's truly an honor. So I am, as you mentioned, I'm a nurse. I'm a nurse practitioner and I'm a scientist. So I worked as a nurse for a very long time and at the bedside. But one of the things that intrigued me from very early on was the scientific inquiry, really asking questions as to why we do what we do. You know, how can we improve the care of patients with science? And really understanding the evidence behind the things that we were actually doing for the patients. So from a very early point in my career, I was fascinated by the scientific inquiry and science in general. So when I had an opportunity to really think about my next steps, it was a no-brainer that I wanted to do a PhD. So I did my PhD at the University of Pennsylvania in the School of Nursing, but I did this in joint with the Monell Chemical Senses Center, where I did all of my dissertation work, primarily looking at taste and how taste was taste sensitivity and taste genetics was associated with obesity in children, and specifically looking at taste sensitivity. So understanding the psychophysics as well as the biology. And then so from there, I then came to the NIH to do a postdoc, primarily focused on just really continue to understand the basic science and biology around obesity, while really keeping in mind a lot of the chemosensory aspects of things. And then I got an opportunity to open my lab, first as an assistant clinical investigator within the intramural program, and then as a Lasker investigator tenure track which I'm currently on. So it's really truly been an honor to be able to do this in within the intramural program, but also create a program of research that is focused on truly understanding how taste and smell varies or does not vary across disease processes. We have a plethora of studies. However, there's a limited number of studies that are done in humans with different disease conditions. So I think that by understanding more about these particular senses that many times people don't think much about, it really will provide a window of opportunity for more innovative questions and ways in which we can develop interventions for patients.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for this wonderful introduction. And again, you're an example to young women that are interested in science, and especially those interested in the dual role of a clinician scientist. Dr. Joseph, Dr. Ioannidis wrote an outstanding editorial on the importance of incorporating systematic reviews in basic science journals. As you know, systematic reviews are considered to be the gold standard in clinical journals. Please tell us what prompted you to write a systematic review instead of a regular review. Our readers will be interested in understanding the difference between this type of reviews.
Thank you, Dr. Madeline, and that's a fantastic question. So one of the things that prompted us to really conduct a systematic review was really for the purpose, as you said, is one of the gold standards in really understanding and identifying prior areas of scholarship, really understanding the foundation on the particular topic that we're interested in, and doing this in a way that it doesn't introduce biases, you know, by following up like the standard ways in which systematic reviews are conducted. And I must say it was not a tall feat to conduct, in terms that it takes a significant amount of time to really explore the literature in depth. But it helps us to really identify the inconsistencies, as I mentioned, gaps in research, conflicts that might be within the literature in terms of previous studies, and really just kind of dive into what other questions are open there for research. And so for us, just looking at the growing interest around fat taste and fat chemosensation, and really in lots of the papers that were coming up, at least in even the last 5 years, in trying to understand what is the mechanisms behind this and what is the context together with obesity, it really pushed us to really consider looking at doing a systematic review to really dive deeper into the literature and understand where the gaps were. So that really prompted us, and this is why we really focus on looking, doing the systematic reviews to summarize the emerging evidence and examining the biological mechanisms of fat, taste, and smell.
Thank you, Dr. Joseph. I was very impressed when I read that you reviewed more than 4,000 articles in a number of databases, some of them that I don't really know that they existed. So I think that shows the power of the systematic reviews. And as you mentioned, you had criteria and you selected 84 articles. Again, this is a great amount of work and we are grateful to you.
Yeah, and I think it's important to also, I think it's also important to highlight that different from maybe some of the narrative reviews, the systematic review takes time to be able to do. As you said, we had to look at 4,000 articles with a specific criteria. So it really took us, I believe, almost 2 years to really get a finished product by really working on it consistently. So I think that this is also a big difference in terms of how deep you go into the literature.
No, I think this is a great achievement. Dr. Joseph, in your review, you mentioned that obesity may be linked with continuous stimulation of fat receptors. Please tell us a bit more about the main receptors responsible for the sensations of taste and smell, and how their activation may contribute to obesity.
Yeah, that's, again, another fantastic question. So just in particular, I think just let's taking it a step back, I think it's also, it's important to really highlight that in the literature, you know, when we look at literature that has been exploring taste, there has primarily been focused on the five taste modalities that we mostly know, which is sweet, bitter, salty, sour, and umami. And for those of individuals who are listening and they're thinking of what is umami, you know, is that fish sauce or like some of anything that's like savory foods? So each of these taste modality has different criteria, and they're activated by specific stimulus. And when it comes to fat, we're thinking that, you know, fat taste in particular are activated by different fatty acids, right? So these stimulation of the chemoreceptor cells are in the mouth and within the taste buds, and they process by our central nervous system to contribute to flavor perception when they also activate smell. So when we think about fat taste in particular, some of the candidates receptors that have been, that we can find in the literature is CD36 and GPR120. Lately, there have been some other emerging, but when we look at the literature in conglomerate, these are the more prominent receptors that have been indicated in terms of being linked to fat taste perception, specifically within the oral cavity.
So how do they contribute to obesity? For example, overstimulation of, you know, these receptors causes to eat more, or how does that occur?
So studies, it's not necessarily that it's contributing to obesity, but one of the things that we see across the literature, if especially when we look at this particular, like the CD36 polymorphisms that have been associated with oral fat taste perception, is that, you know, as we look across the different polymorphisms and we look at the literature, there's quite of inconsistent findings, right? This is one of the reasons why we couldn't really do a meta-analysis on this, was because there was the difference and the heterogeneity of the findings. For example, there's one particular SNP, like the RS157, 483, that variants were not associated with obesity in particular. However, there's ones that have been associated with waist circumference, but they see that there is some sort of low, individuals will have a low BMI, but it's associated with increased waist circumference. So when we look at this literature, it's really difficult to really say and pinpoint a causal effect. So that's why I think we really need to do more studies, just really understanding causal mechanisms that, or if there's any, as to how these receptors are being upregulated, downregulated, or in essence, if there are any changes that then might be contributing to changes in intake and ingestive behaviors.
Perfect, thank you. Dr. Joseph, we are familiar that one of the most unpleasant complications of COVID is the loss of taste and smell. How does SARS-CoV-2 result in loss of taste and smell? And what are the consequences on affected people? Recently we published a great editorial by Dr. Michael Sag on the tale of two epidemics. He compared and contrasted HIV to COVID. And as far as I know, there is no loss of taste reception in HIV or in any other respiratory viruses such as RSV and influenza. Would you kindly expand on this topic?
Yes, absolutely. And truly, COVID has been an enigma to all of us. I think the last 2.5 years, 3 years has really created an opportunity for growth in learning and just understanding of areas that have been not necessarily readily in our minds at that particular point in time. So when it comes to taste and smell dysfunction, especially when COVID, I still think about this, and it's been truly fascinating because, as you said, other viruses don't necessarily produce the same magnitude of taste and smell loss as we saw when COVID, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, when the early variants, things changed a little bit when the later variants, but this was particularly interesting. And one of the other interesting pieces is that we know that individuals don't necessarily complain of taste and smell loss all the time. Even if someone has a cold or flu and they have a stuffy nose and they can smell something, it's temporary. But what we saw in COVID was really a big change. We saw that these changes were happening in a greater magnitude, and it was happening in a large number of individuals. And as we saw that some individuals did not recover, actually developed long COVID. So with this, what we have learned so far, we have learned a lot more in terms of the biology and the mechanisms of how COVID is affecting smell, a lot more than we have in terms of taste. But one of the things that we know is that maybe the SARS-CoV-2 might target the substantacular cells rather than the olfactory sensory neurons or the olfactory bulb. And then these have shown that there's some downregulation of the olfactory receptors and signaling molecules that might be affected. So in terms of taste, one of the things that have been suggested is that there's that direct infection of the taste bud cells by the SARS-CoV-2. And there's an elegant paper by Dr. Josephine Egan really showing how the virus might be affecting these taste bud cells within the oral cavity, which is truly fascinating because this is something that we really didn't think much about. In terms of long COVID, there's still a lot more work to really be done to really understand what is causing the parosmia and the phantasmia that many of these individuals are having. Those that initially had some inkling of recovery, but now they're having these smell distortions. And then those individuals that have not recovered at all. And some of these individuals have gotten affected from early in the pandemic. And one particular thing that has been troublesome is the fact that, you know, in essence, we don't have a lot of pharmacological agents that are effective. And this is really why it's truly important to not only invest in terms of the basic science and understanding mechanisms, but really get more clinician scientists really asking these questions as to how can we really help these individuals? What else do we need, you know, can we use? Can we really start looking at probably some other available drugs that might be helpful? Can we understand more in terms of stem cells regeneration, even post-COVID and winning the taste buds? There's so many questions to be asked and that we require answers to really develop effective therapeutic treatments for these individuals that had been affected by COVID. But even that, then we also need pharmacological agents that can help those individuals that had taste loss before and smell loss before COVID.
This would be a wonderful advance because I have heard a lot of people complaining that, you know, food tastes like cardboard, for example. And that's one of the greatest pleasures in life. So if there are any research results in pharmacological modulation, if you will, mm-hmm. of the loss of taste and smell, I think this would be wonderful. Yeah. Dr. Joseph, you mentioned that several receptor polymorphisms are associated with lack of chemosensation. Can you expand on this topic? Are polymorphisms associated with obesity or conversely with very low BMI? You mentioned that a little bit before, but could you expand a little bit on this, please?
Yes, absolutely. So as I mentioned earlier, the most frequently studied genetic polymorphisms associated with fat chemosensations are of those of the CD36. And we have several of them that we highlight in our paper. And we have, I think, one of the tables, table five, that really summarizes several of the papers that we found that looked at these specific polymorphisms. And as I mentioned earlier, I think one of the particular things that we had that we see is, for example, there's one particular paper by Plesnik et al. From 2018 that looked at Czech individuals from Czech Republic. And they looked at males and females, and they saw that for this particular SNP, the participants that had a CC genotype for the RS 152-7483 polymorphism had a lower BMI, and then also had a decreased waist circumference and waist to height ratio, but they had a higher sensitivity to linoleic acid than participants that had the other genotypes. However, there's another paper that was published a little bit earlier by another group, also in same Czech young adults, that saw that the variants were not associated with obesity. So then it goes back to the same points that I tried to make earlier, that it's really hard to pinpoint a causal relationship when we see these differences across the literature. And I think this really highlights why doing a systematic review is important, because we can really see how the results may compare or may not compare across studies.
Thank you very much. That's very important to know. Dr. Joseph, do environmental factors play a role in the regulation of fat and smell receptors? For example, nomadic people eat mainly fat because of its high calorie intake. Is that because they have better or more receptors for fat? Personally, I crave salty foods. And based on what you mentioned in your review, ENaC must be overexpressed on my tongue. So can you expand on this? How does the environment modify what we eat, for example? And are there changes in our receptors because of the environment?
That's a good question. Actually, as I read this question, I was smiling, thinking about how much I also like salty foods. So one of the things that it's really important to think when we're looking at the physiology of the taste buds, it's important to remember that taste buds turn over with a half-life of 8 to 24 days. So they are in constant state of development. So one can think that, of course, that I hope that the nutrition that we have may in turn be sensitive to, provide sensitivity in terms of the dietary intake that we have in terms of the taste buds. So then changing, for example, thinking about it having epigenetic effect, overconsumption might create upregulation and downregulation of receptors. And there's an elegant short narrative review by Robin Dando from Cornell, primarily looking at this, and I believe that we mentioned this, in terms of seeing, for example, exactly what you mentioned in terms of salt, like how a diet that's overly salty might change the expression of these receptors within the oral cavity. So then leading us to think that an inability to correctly identify, for example, salt concentration might be linked to sodium consumption. And this has been shown by several individuals within the field. So going back to your nomadic example, one can think that there might be also evolutionary changes that may occur, that might be occurring within these individuals that make them adapt to really eating this more high-fat diet. And then it would be fascinating to also understand what are the long-term effects, because as you said, they're eating this diet consistently. So what are the changes that happen in the periphery, and then long-term effects in terms of obesity and other metabolic diseases.
Thank you very much, Sana. Dr. Joseph, you are a highly successful neuroscientist working as a nurse practitioner and a scientist and a role model for the younger generation. Do you have any suggestions of how we can improve the outreach and impact of physiological reviews, especially in the nursing community?
Thank you, Dr. Madeline, for this question. And I do have ideas. So I think that one of the things that as I looked at your question and I'm listening to your question, that really made me reflect about how rich the curriculum of nursing is in terms of anatomy, physiology, and the opportunities that really we can use as educators to incorporate articles from physiological reviews in our lectures. And then, you know, just having access to up-to-date material. One of the things that you and I know is that often, you know, we use textbooks that might be updated gradually. But one of the things that we learned when COVID is that we need this information to be at the tip of our hands and to be readily available for us. And nurses being at the forefront of healthcare. And it's really important that we have up-to-date information on the science, on the physiology, on different things that we are learning in terms of the anatomy. And this is really one of the reasons that I particularly love basic science, because it really makes us think beyond, you know, why are we giving this medication to the patient, right? Like really understanding what is it doing at the cellular level. So if we can really have access, provide more access to nurses, both at the bedside, nursing students, nurse practitioners who are actively working in the field, access to physiological reviews, I believe would be a goldmine of information that could really impact patient care in real time.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm hoping that you and I can work effectively to perhaps target nursing curriculum and in our social media and even in our reviews. I think this is a wonderful opportunity. My sincere thanks to you for taking the time to participate in this podcast. And also my sincere thanks to you for making a dream come true when I was being interviewed for the position of editor 5 years ago. I had promised the APS publication committee that we will incorporate systematic reviews in our journal. We have made that dream come true. It took 5 years, but the first product was worth the wait and the effort. Thank you so much, Dr. Joseph. And I am really looking forward to your numerous contributions to physiological reviews.
Thank you so much. Thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Physiological Reviews podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate and review the podcast wherever you listen to it, and be sure to share it with your friends and colleagues. Check out our other articles and find other podcast episodes on our website at prv.org.